Ohio Bell, the telephone company, presents the Ohio Story. It used to be that the first thing a Hiram alumnus told you was that James A. Garfield went to his school. Now that's the second thing he tells you, because first he has to explain about the Hiram plan. A little college of 350 students like Hiram used to be doesn't usually lead the pack, even if it has educated the president. But Hiram did, and it's still out in front with a big new idea in education that looks like it will go down in bold-faced type in the Ohio Story.
That was Robert Waldrop beginning another Ohio Story, brought to you by Ohio Bell, the telephone company. One of the things of which we Americans are justifiably proud is that any child born in this country has a chance to become president of the United States. That American tradition of equal opportunity prevails in industry, too. Take the telephone business, for instance. Lee Wilson, recently appointed president of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company and top man in the Bell system, began his telephone career by installing telephones while working his way through college. His first full-time job was that of a timekeeper, and his success story is repeated throughout the Bell system. The policy of unlimited opportunity and promotion through the ranks gives telephone people a reason to be alert and, consequently, provides even more courteous and efficient telephone service for you. And now back to Robert Waldrop and tonight's Ohio Story, the Hiram Plan.
It's hard to see why the idea should have hatched at Hiram in Portage County, Ohio. Hiram College had only 28 professors and 350 students. But you might say it began over a faculty breakfast.
Goyle, I want to talk with you. Pass the sugar.
Si, Donato. You're having trouble, eh? These students cannot cube the root, maybe?
We're having no difficulty with roots. Our trouble is Spanish.
Well, about that, I know something. How can I help?
By letting up on your students a little. Every day I hear the same thing. I couldn't finish my trigonometry, sir, because Professor Goyaz assigned me too much Spanish. Mathematics always waits till last. Then there's no time for it.
Oh, no. Always they must do math. No time for Spanish.
Well, if I had them free and clear, full time for a month, I'd accomplish more than I do now in a whole year.
You would. If I had such a privilege, my students, they would be speaking Spanish like in Madrid.
While that kind of thinking was going on in the faculty, there was a similar condition among the students.
Bill, what time is it?
A little after nine.
Boy, I wish I didn't have anything to do but history tonight.
What are you, an eager beaver?
No, just got interested, that's all. Those old boys really played rough.
What do you mean?
Well, take Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. They were in the army together, and they were always giving each other the needle.
Yeah?
Then they battle each other in politics. Finally, Burr gets a little edge. He has a chance for the governorship in New York. So Hamilton writes an open letter calling Burr a crook. Burr right away ups and challenges Hamilton to a duel.
Who was right?
I don't know. I gotta quit history and start my math so I can finish it in time to do my Spanish.
I know what you mean. I'm in the same fix.
Intensive study. One subject at a time. Let the student study math exclusively for a couple of months.
Then Spanish.
I'd like to teach psychology that way.
And if a student had to quit in the middle of the year, he'd at least have two completed courses instead of five half-finished.
And he would not have five final exams to cram for at the end of the year.
He'd learn twice as fast.
But it would be an experiment. And I trust he's got too much money, Woody, to bother with experiments.
I know it.
Trouble with you men is you didn't study your psychology.
Psychology.
When a boy wants an excuse to drive the car, how does he ask his dad?
Charades, now we play.
He says, Dad, do you need anything at the store? And usually, Dad needs some pipe tobacco.
So?
Well, the trustees are worried about money, and they want to put the college equipment to work during the idle summer months.
Why, of course.
We'll offer the plan for summer school. Who'll go with me to see President Brown?
In the summer of 1931, 81 students and 11 professors embarked upon a new experiment in learning. The first 3 weeks were promising.
Well, it's worked out fine for my classes. Of course, I suppose your students are pretty sick of Spanish.
Sick of it? Why, already my classroom is sounding like the market in Barcelona. For mathematics, let's not get stuffy so much at a time.
You know, I really got interested in this Burr. Quite a character. Do you know the story of his Brenner-Hassett conspiracy?
You don't have to study that, do you?
Don't have to, but I'm interested. With this new system, there's time to explore.
Well, after that summer, there were 81 students and 11 professors at Hiram who clamored to put the regular college session on their intensive plan. But the trustees said, try it another summer. They tried it 3 summers, and when the results were in, there wasn't one scrap of tangible evidence to favor the plan. No revenue had been produced, nor any geniuses either. Enrollment dropped off. There was some intangible evidence, though. The participating students and the professors were in love with the system. And that's why you have to tip your hat to the Hiram trustees. On January the 8th, 1934, there was a fateful meeting.
Well, gentlemen, since you faculty men voted for it, we'll try it. We'll divide the year into 4 9-week periods with one running course. We'll try it 3 years. However, during that time, we expect you to prove your case. By June 1936, you've got to show us complete, concrete, and documentary evidence that the system is all you say. Otherwise, we drop it.
The professors would have agreed to most anything. They went to work. Every examination paper under the new system was tabulated and compared to exams written under the old system. These tabulations were carefully stored in a special room on the top floor of the administration building. It was all to be fuel for what the faculty considered would be the biggest sales effort of their lives. They pinned their hopes on the records accumulating on the top floor of the administration building. The first quarter under the new Hiram plan ended on November 10th, 1934. The period had gone well. There was new joy in teaching. There was proof of it, too, because by November 12th, the comparative grades had all been carefully carried to the top floor of the administration building. At 10:40 on the evening of November 13th, 2 students were walking across the south campus to the book nook for a cup of coffee. The night was cold and clear, and the students came abreast of the administration building.
Only trouble with this system is you get so interested you hate to drop a subject when the quarter's over.
I got a feeling maybe that's good. Hey, you smell something funny?
Yeah. Hey, look. Fire!
I saved most of the stuff in the treasurer's safe.
The safe? The devil with the safe? Come on, you men. Get those records on the top floor.
Hey, you can't go up there now.
Come on!
Don't go in there!
There was a big timber over it. I couldn't lift.
Oh.
Then we had to turn back. You can't get at it from the inside.
We gotta try a ladder. Hey, hurry with that ladder.
Come on, bring it over.
Never mind the ladder. There goes the roof.
See? There goes all our proof.
There goes everything.
Before the smoke cleared, the faculty knelt around a heap of blackened papers, watching Professor Goyaz carefully pick up a black sheet. They watched it disintegrate in his fingers and blow away in the wind. There was still time before the showdown to collect more records, but in a Hiram-sized college, when 2 buildings go, you've lost a lot of college. The Hiram plan suffered a costly interruption while the college reorganized. The period for collecting data was cut short. The proof must now be in by December 1936. The evaluation committee prepared its estimate of the Hiram plan. It was not glowing. On the day of the trustees' meeting, students and professors watched the cars roll up. They watched the solemn gentleman walk into the president's office, and they wondered, when that afternoon ran out, would they be in ordinary college again, or would they be on the Hiram plan? But the solemn gentlemen were also wise. Maybe that's why they were trustees.
Let's skip over the routine business. We all know the question.
The proof has not been conclusive.
Hardly.
But, gentlemen, we're in an odd position. Our vote is the deciding one, yet the faculty vote follows ours. Now, if we vote to continue the Hiram plan, for all we know, we may be saddling the faculty with a plan they know won't work. If we vote to discontinue, we may lose something they know is great.
Are you suggesting we leave the question up to the faculty?
Exactly.
Well, that vote of confidence put new breath into the faculty. On December the 11th, 1936, they voted to continue the Hiram intensive study plan. It was a good thing, too, because, you see, other people were watching the outcome of that meeting. Distant parts of this world were interested in Hiram's private little battle. It came through the mail. New hope, a pat on the back, a gesture of recognition. In one letter was a check from the Carnegie Foundation, earmarked for the continuation of the Hiram study plan. Time magazine and the educational journals paid tribute then to Hiram's great experiment and its big little battle. It's been only 17 years now, so thinking men at Hiram aren't shouting from the rooftops about how wonderful their system is. Time will tell. But they do know for sure that the 650 students who study there now wouldn't have it any other way. It's beyond the experimental stage. They notice, too, that the Hiram plan went into Berea and Transylvania in Kentucky, Eureka, Illinois, William Penn College in Iowa, Chapman College in Los Angeles, California, and from there it appears to be spreading. And they have a feeling that win, lose, or draw, the new idea will add immeasurably to old Hiram's chapter in the Ohio story.
And now, before we close the Ohio story, here is Robert Waldrop with his Ohio Bell Brevity.
Perhaps you listen to a radio program which has been popular for 11 years, The Answer Man. Maybe you have sent him questions and have wondered how he knows so much about everything. Well, The Answer Man is really a large research organization comprising a staff of more than 50 experts with a library of 10,000 volumes and a list of about 20,000 different authorities covering all fields of knowledge. These authorities are consulted quite often by long-distance telephone. Questions pour into The Answer Man at the rate of 6,000 a week, and everybody gets an answer, on the air or by mail. Naturally, it would be impossible to handle such a big project without the long-distance telephone, particularly when many questions deal with distant places. But whether it's a matter of business or of personal interest, if you want a quick answer to a question, the quickest way to get it is through a long-distance telephone call. It's direct and immediate, and the cost is surprisingly low.
Ohio Bell will bring you Robert Waldrop in the Ohio story again Monday evening at this same time, when we tell the story of the magnificent ride of Ann Bailey, who rode the Ohio frontier as messenger, Indian scout, and riflewoman. Listen Monday for Mad Ann Bailey's Empty Grave. The Ohio story, brought to you every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at this same time, is produced by Stuart Buchanan and written by Frank Seidel. Original music by Earl Roth. Until Monday at this same time, this is Tom Field saying good night for Ohio Bell and reminding you that your gift to the American Cancer Society fights cancer three ways: through education, service, and research. This is a special network of Ohio radio stations.